cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
Who killed the G7 economy? Western media is rife with reports denigrating the Chinese economy. China can't shake deflation. China's economy is killed. Investing in China is risky. But in November, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, upgraded China's real GDP growth from 5% to 5.4% for this year. It also predicted China's economy to be on track to meet its growth target. Meanwhile, the G7 economic bloc looks like in need of urgent attention, if not action. The OECD estimates the bloc's quarter-on-quarter growth to be 0.3% in Q3. Except the United States, which saw some acceleration, the remaining G7 countries recorded zero, close to zero, or negative growth for the same period of time. So I ask, who killed the G7 economy? Why are they not contributing more to global growth? Why are some in the Western media fixated on China? I'm pleased to be joined here in the studio by Yu Kong Huang, Senior Fellow of the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. So, you know, let's focus on the real problem here. Mm. And I think the real problem for the global economy is not China, but really the OECD or G7 economies. Do you agree with this assessment?
If we're part of an integrated world, developed countries are responsible for a much larger share. Their prospects have been declining steadily over the past year. They've been hit by inflation in many countries. Europe has suffered a lot from the fact that the war in Ukraine has cut off energy supplies, raised commodities. Trade has become more difficult. Investment levels have stagnated. Japan has not been able to get out of its doldrums. The U.S. is doing better than the others. But even others, even most market observers predict that the American economy is going to slow down, and inflation is still a big issue. If you survey the American public, they actually say that they think the economy is actually not doing very well. And this is causing a big problem for President Biden, mm-hmm. because he thinks that the unemployment is coming down, GDP growth rates on paper seem very strong, but inflation is persistent. And in the minds of many people, that is a big issue.
So in general, in short, it's a very gloomy picture for the developed bloc, isn't it? I mean, even the United States doing relatively well for Q3 was only 1.2% growth from the 0.5% for Q2. Overall, how bad is it?
Well, everybody in the West is running into what I call fiscal problems. America has a huge budget deficits, pressure to cut back. This is not going to be helpful in terms of expanding growth. Trade volumes are slowing down. Supply chains have been disrupted. Many of the European economies depend upon smooth functioning trade patterns. And now they've not been able to export to Russia. They had to go around to get to the Pacific. Energy prices are becoming erratic and volatile. Commodity prices are going up and down. Unemployment is becoming a persistent issue. A lot of migration, legal or illegal, is causing a lot of pressures on governments. The IMF forecast suggests that growth next year will be declining, and this is affecting everyone. But I should also mention that some of this negative impact is also affecting poor countries, too. The poorer the countries are, in fact, they've been even hit worse off. Mm. The richer countries have a little bit more resources to deal with it, but they have not been unaffected.
So, in terms of China, China recorded the IMF says China is going to grow to 5.4%. The original estimate was 5%. So would you say that China's economy, looking against the backdrop of what we just talked about, is actually trying its best and it's not too bad?
Well, it's not too bad in the sense that, as you say, it's still significantly better than it was last year. But last year was a low base. The big issue is the future, and that's the same is true with the U.S. and the same is true in China. There are many people in the U.S. worry about a potential recession still. They still worry about inflationary pressures. Mm-hmm. In China, the question is growth going to return to something like a sustainable 4 to 5%? If China could grow 4 to 5% on a sustainable financial basis for the next 5 to 10 years, that would be great. This is an upper-middle-income country, likely to become a rich country within the next decade. 5% growth regularly without strong stimulus is very successful.
Well, just now you talked about last year being a low base for obvious reasons, the COVID restriction China suffered particularly hard. But the other G7 economies, for instance, would you say that they don't have the same baggage?
Well, they didn't have the same problem that China had in terms of the post-COVID recovery. Europe, and particularly the United States, focused on fiscal expansion, budgetary support, social welfare systems to maintain very high consumption levels. In fact, they probably overdid it. And that's why you see very strong inflation in the United States in particular and somewhat in Europe. The budgetary support, feeding income transfers to the general population, led to a huge surge in consumption. China did not feed a lot of support to the general population. China was somewhat fortunate, actually. It was able, during the pandemic and COVID period, to boost up exports of manufactured goods. And there was a huge demand for this in the West. They didn't, in some ways, have to actually support general employment levels through fiscal expansion. But nevertheless, there is what I call a need or concern about whether or not the general population in China, not getting this budgetary support, their consumption levels have not surged as much as it has in the West. So you have a funny kind of a situation. Yes, consumption surged, but you also have these inflationary pressures and questions of whether this is financially sustainable. There's tremendous pressure in the U.S., for example, to cut the budget. You don't have this kind of surge in consumption here, but there's also concern about what will drive growth in China in the future, because consumption has not rebounded as much as people had hoped for.
We seem to see conflicting things. On the one hand, their economy is staggering. I'm talking about the G7 economy. On the other hand, they're complaining about cheap products from China. They want to, you know, more protective measures, for instance, against electronic vehicles coming from China. Are they barking at the wrong tree?
Well, the trouble with the trade patterns is that such a sudden change. If you look at the inflow of electric vehicles coming from China to Europe, the rise is very, very large, very, very quickly. Right. It's hard for the European market to digest it. The same thing was true with solar panels, wind turbine engines 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. All of a sudden, China became very efficient, and markets were in the West, and the surge was very, very quick. So this is what's called the speed of the change that was really a problem. It has to be some kind of moderated a bit. So I think there should be more of a discussion between EU and China about the inflow of electric vehicles and the batteries. Europe needs these batteries. America needs these batteries. America is restricting it a lot. They won't allow Chinese battery makers to establish plants. They're reluctant to let any Chinese electric vehicles come in.
Yeah. That's like stopping the future from coming.
Absolutely. You lose the technology and prices rise. And then you have this inflationary pressure in the United States because of this. Prices in the United States have increased by, let's say, 40 to 50%. During the pandemic years,
yeah.
And you're talking about whether it's clothing, food, cars,
across
services, all across the board. And that's why the polls in the United States of the general public, they basically complaining about the economy. Mm-hmm. And this is surprising to the Democratic Party, because from their perception, they thought that all this kind of investment, this expansion, this consumer protection, people would actually, and in fact, unemployment rates fall a lot, that the general public would be quite happy, but they're not. So this
the prices are the...
The price is the thing.
Yeah, but for the case of Europe, because European Union leaders have also started to complain about a burgeoning trade deficit against China, is that a similar issue, or is Europe in a very different position? They're really... And for instance, what Europe sells to China, what China sells to Europe are different things, obviously.
The Europe concern about a major trade deficit with China is, in my view, a temporary concern. Prior to this last year and possibly next year, the EU has been running a trade surplus. It's been running a trade surplus for 10 to 15 years, contrary to the US, which runs deficits. So Europe may run a trade deficit with China, but it runs a huge trade surplus with the rest of the world. And that means its overall balance has been in surplus. So it's trade deficit issue with China was relatively small and insignificant, didn't matter too much, because overall Europe was in the surplus. But this Ukraine war, higher energy prices, that has made a huge difference.
And China's electric vehicle.
And electrical vehicles have surged. So all this has come together at the same time. Mm-hmm. I don't think you will see a huge deficit, European trade deficit with China next year. This is a temporary issue. So I don't think that's a significant concern. Mm-hmm.
But what is that? Does that have a direct impact on the economic outlook of the EU bloc or the G7 economies?
Well, the EU bloc has a general problem, in my view. It's relied upon manufacturing and services to drive its economy. It's hit by the fact that it was getting commodities and energy relatively cheaply from Russia and no longer can do so. It has to pay higher energy prices into the future. The second thing is it's finding that it's falling behind both China and the U.S. in terms of innovation and technology, whether it's the green technologies or the digital activities.
Is it because over-regulation, bureaucracy, lack of efficiency?
They have not been able to coordinate their efforts. If you want to be truly innovative these days, it's a lot easier if you do it on a big scale. Okay, Europe together is big, but individually it is small. They've not been able to coordinate what I call the promotion of technology innovation as a European issue. It's a specific country, and each country is relatively small. It's unlike the United States. Yeah. The United States is going very heavily in trying to promote artificial intelligence, pharmaceuticals. You don't see these leaders in Europe.
Yeah.
Now, Germany was always seen as a high-quality manufacturing economy.
Right.
But if you think about it very carefully, they're not seen as an innovative economy. They're seen as precise, precision, high quality. Europe has been seen, for example, as fashion, as art, everything else. But technology, that was never its strength. In the new world, this is a big concern. And they feel like they're falling behind, not just the United States, but they feel like they're even falling behind China, which is rising very quickly.
So this is the first time you visit China since the pandemic broke out. What is your impression? Because from what you read in the news, I guess back in the United States is a different picture. When you're here, the dynamism, the vitality, the kind of discussion that's been going on, what kind of feeling does that give you in terms of China's economic outlook in the near future, at least?
Well, you're right. It's been 4 years since I've been able to come back to China. I went to Shanghai. I spent a lot of time. I spent a lot of time with Chinese businesses. Here, I spent a lot of time with Chinese policymakers. That dynamism, that spirit of energy still exists here in China. China's greatest strength is its competitive. Firms are very competitive. They're searching for constantly for new ideas. So I have a lot of confidence, in fact, that China will continue to grow fairly rapidly. But there is a temporary problem, the property bubble. And the property bubble is going to be serious because it accounts for a large share of growth. Mm. The fact that OECD in Europe, United States, growth will slow down, creates a problem for China because they may not buy as many Chinese products. So China faces a concern that they may not be able to export as much. Mm. So the property market is a problem. Exports may not be as dynamic. So then the big issue is, how can China drive growth? And the answer is, there's still a lot of things that China can do. But they're sensitive. Some of these issues are sensitive. I'll give you a very simple issue. Where is the demand going to come from in China if you're not going to come from a property? It's not going to come from trade. It's going to have to come from consumption or domestic investment. People talk a lot about hukou reform in China.
Who?
Hukou reform. Migrant workers do not have full residency rights in major cities. So major cities in China, about 40% of the population don't have hukou, but they don't write to local services. So people talk about this as a social issue, but it's a major economic issue. Because migrant workers, they save at a rate of 40% higher than normal Chinese. Mm. If they had full residency rights, for example, and they consumed like other Chinese households, consumption in China would increase by 30%. Mm. That would increase China's growth rate by a full percentage point, just by itself, and had no cost. So there are lots of these kinds of things that China can do in the future, and that could maintain adequate demand. So I'm pretty confident that the government is starting to look at these issues, and that China therefore could grow at a rate of 5% on a sustainable fashion for the future.
Hopefully. And thank you very much for such analysis and insight for the future and suggestions as well. Please continue, keep them coming so that the Chinese economy can be in a better shape, but also for the G7 economies, because as you said, the world economy is intertwined. We cannot do well on our own. Many thanks. We have to leave it there. Yu Konghuang, Senior Fellow of the Asia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you.
We all enter this world with a universal greeting. We then learn to speak.
Bonjour, comment allez-vous?
Hoy estoy muy contenta.
Though our languages, cultures, and traditions may differ, we still share one thing in common. We have hope for humanity and the world.
German railway company Deutsche Bahn,
the 26th United Nations Climate
Change. Hear the difference. Join our global network to connect with the world.
The world is about to change. Warriors, assassins, fair maidens, court officials, and even emperors and heavenly immortals are nothing but pawns on a giant chessboard. Xu Fengnian, a playboy of national notoriety and heir to the empire's second most powerful man, finds himself embroiled in the depths of unbeatable game. CGTN Radio invites you to immerse in a world brimming with heroism and follow a young man's odyssey in the audio drama series, The Sword Strider Saga, now available on radio.cgtn.com and all the major podcast platforms. When courage meets wisdom, The Sword Scribes, an immortal legend.
Making room for all opinions and seeing events from more than one side. This is The Point.
What's the free trade of the future? A French man gave his answer 131 years ago. Rowers, runners, and fences are what he suggested to be exported to the world because by doing so, he believes the cause of peace will receive new and powerful support. This Frenchman was Pierre de Coubertin, known as the father of the modern Olympic Games. In commemoration of the 160th anniversary of his birth, an activity was held in Beijing to remember him, during which a proposal was made to establish November the 25th as the Olympic Culture Day. Why do we talk about Olympic culture today? What relevance does Coubertin's words have for today's world? I'm pleased to be joined by Dong Jun, a sports business analyst from Beijing here in the studio. But first, let's hear from Maria de Jesus Fernandez, a Spanish international student at Beijing Language and Culture University, what she had to say about the proposal.
I think the Olympic spirit is to get everyone from every part of the world and making a family. And sports make us a better person. We've been able to not only compete for ourselves or for our country, but also for other people around the world and inspire them to want to do, to play sports and to have this feeling of community and be together and make new friends.
Well, very simple words from very positive young person. Mr. Dong, what is your understanding of the significance of Olympic Culture Day? It's not a national initiative, it's not an official initiative, it's an initiative by people who love the games, I guess. But what could be the intention behind such a proposal?
Yes, Liu Jin, I'm also trying very my best to come to terms with or make sense of what has happened. And, you know, as an Olympic fan, as a sports fan, I'm happy about everything, you know, sports fans propose to maximize their inspiration and what they do. But, you know, we have already have an International Olympic Day, which falls on the 23rd of June every year. In addition to that particular day, with a lot of activities taking place on that day and maybe that week, do we also need another day of significance?
Yeah, what's the difference? November. What is Olympic culture?
Yes, I think that's the key word, Olympic culture. Maybe people think that the International Olympic Day in late June will be primarily about a lot of athletic activities for people to celebrate. But by, you know, tracing back to the original speech given by Mr. Coubertin, maybe people would be interested in figuring out what's actually behind those words that we can borrow and discuss, and so that we can expand what we believe in the games and competitions into other areas of our life.
How about let's recall those words together first. In November 18 to 1892. See, I can't even say that name correctly. 1892, that's a long time ago. Pierre de Coubertin's first public call for the revival of the Olympic Games goes, let us export rowers, runners, and fencers. This is the free trade of the future, and the day that it is introduced into the everyday existence of old Europe. The cause of peace will receive new and powerful support. The cause of peace will receive new and powerful support. So, Professor Dong, this sound very idealistic, right? I mean, to talk about peace, to talk about these nice picture of people coming under the same, behind the same ideal and be friends with each other. Is that really possible?
Yes, I once again about this proposal. It comes to culture now. I think it's significant because for people with the least knowledge about the Olympic Games, runners, rowers, competitors, football players would immediately come to their mind, even with very little knowledge about the Olympic movement. But when it comes to peace, in that speech, tolerance, compromises, and even truce in conflicting areas, so that's the significance that we can discuss about what kind of games universally acceptable to all cultures, to various people of different religions, that they can play the same games by engaging in the same sports, that they can put aside and forget about their differences for a while at least, that we can discuss deeper into this belief and ideal.
Why do you think Chinese people have a particular penchant towards the Olympic spirit, towards Olympic culture, towards hosting Olympic Games? Beijing was not just hosting the summer, but also the Winter Olympic Games. Why such identification, let's say, with the movement?
I should say that, you know, even the ancient Greek Olympics and also modern Olympics have come to China relatively, not very early to this nation. But it also demonstrated that the large population, one of the largest in the world, were so open-minded that they very quickly and immediately received.
How come? Is there something deep in our blood, in our genes, that resonates with this probably?
I think led by the most intellectual people in this country more than a century ago and in later decades, people were open to discuss about what has been, you know, wrong with our civilization or culture that make us relatively backward compared to the rest of the world. And then people besides, you know, science and technologies and other stuff, and they realize that maybe we should physically be stronger and we should catch up with the world. We open to the more advanced world by playing similar games and see our potentials.
Is there, yeah, I think that's a great move. And right now the Chinese are crazy about sports. I mean, we are in big numbers. So
they have even greater, you know, potential.
Yeah, well, but still, I think there is something that the Chinese find. For instance, this idea of choose, this idea of we are competing against each other, but we're friends, we can be friends. I see a connection in traditional Chinese culture with that spirit too.
Absolutely, yes. And in maybe in China, so-called Chinese sports, we have martial arts. We have various exercises, and we also would promote the you know, philosophical idea that you should stop where you already secured your win over your opponents.
All right.
And then, if not, shake hands, and you use gestures to make sure that people will come back to this game peacefully next time.
Thank you very much, Dong Jun, mm-hmm. for these very interesting interpretations.
We
have to leave it there. And that's it for this special edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin, coming to you from Beijing. You've got The Point.
Delve into a world of words with Books and Beyond, a podcast made especially for audiobook lovers.
I came into the world as the youngest of five
children. I wondered what Her Majesty would be like.
Fie upon you, limpid one.
Why have you taken...
Immerse yourself in gripping stories and timeless classics from the comfort of your own personal space.
Sun Tzu underlined 3 points on the context gained
initiative.
There was
no better wine, and not to mention the...
Whether you're a bookworm or a casual listener, our carefully curated selection of audiobooks will transport you to new worlds and stir your imagination. Subscribe to Books and Beyond and start your audiobook adventure now on radio.cgtn.com or your favorite podcast app.
Once upon a time, in a land not so very far away, stories were told of the brave and the bold.
The whole court fell silent to hear what the great warrior Mulan might ask for.
Of mighty deities and powerful immortals.
Immediately, the shimmering skin started to grow before his eyes.
Of fated love and love sanctified.
In dawn's golden light, Mulang said,
"Marry me."
Of great journeys across fantastical landscapes.
So the cat and the mouse climbed on the dog's back, and the dog swam across the broad river.
In the company of friends and enemies and unimagined beasts.
Yeah. Good to see you.
Of ordinary folk with tantalizing stories to tell. Heroes and heroines all.
It's incredible. How did you do that?
Tales of sad sacrifice and victories snatched from the jaws of defeat. Stories of the wise, the accomplished, and the quick of mind. 5,000 years of amazing Chinese folk tales. You'll find Chinese Folk Tales Season 3 wherever you discover your favorite podcasts.